You're listening to Dakota Midday on SDPB Radio. I'm Steve Zwemke. Dr. Bull Bennett is one of the lead authors of the Third National Climate Assessment and a PhD graduate from the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. Bennett is a member of the Mi'kmaq tribe of Maine. He recently spoke at the School of Mines about the impact climate has on indigenous nations and water resources. This marks the first in a multi-part series of interviews on energy and the environment this month, as SDPB's Charles Michael Ray caught up with Bennett for an interview about the efforts to understand climate change.
Dr. Bennett, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
I want to ask right off the top, you were one of the authors of the National Climate Assessment. For those out there who don't know what the National Climate Assessment is, what is it?
Well, it's in response to the Global Change Act. Congress mandates every 4 years that we assess the state of the climate, and specifically its impacts in the United States. And so this is a congressional mandate. And so every 4 years, there's a call out for the all stakeholders, scientific community, industry, to come together and provide, to gather technical inputs based on those technical inputs to generate as accurate and transparent product assessment of what the current state and projected state of the climate is going to be. And so I was a member of the third assessment effort.
Thank you very much. I took a look at the national, obviously, a big picture perspective in many ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we were, our particular chapter was new to the process. So we were really cutting new trail with this one. And so we looked at, it was identified as a cross-sectoral chapter, and rightfully so, because a lot of the different sectors within the assessment, whether it be transportation, whether it be water, whether it be food, agriculture, Indigenous communities intersect all, and so that chapter became a cross-sectoral chapter. And so our approach was to try and gather as much information from all four directions as we possibly could, from not just the federally recognized tribes, but all Indigenous communities.
I want to ask a question from some of the skeptics in the public that I've heard from over the years. While there is scientific consensus on climate change, there are skeptics out there who I've heard point back to the 70s and say, hey, in the 70s, there was this research on an ice age, and now science has flip-flopped, and we don't know what to believe because these scientists are going back and forth. And I want to ask about that research in the 70s on the ice age that received a lot of national media attention.
Well, in terms of the 70s effort, there were different research priorities at the time. And so those that were really addressing climate in terms of critical mass, they weren't as many climate scientists, arguably, that were focused on the issues as there are now. And it certainly wasn't the third rail topic that it is now. But to quell some of the discussions, let me provide this example. You have an ailment, and so you go and seek out the medical advice of 100 medical doctors. 97 of those medical doctors all come back and say, yes, this is what your condition is. 3 of those medical doctors say, well, it could be, but we don't know. Who are you going to listen to? So in terms of consensus, the scientific community, there is no debate. It's whether or not people choose to accept fact. And the fact remains, or the fact is, and the volume of data, of evidence supporting this is astronomical. And it's really a question of people accepting fact, getting beyond that part of the discussion, and really getting into informed decision making and setting policy that could really affect change. You know, we're wasting time. Our window of opportunity to do stuff is waning quickly. And if we get bogged down in these kinds of rhetoric and, you know, we waste a lot of time in those kinds of discussions, time that could otherwise be used for problem solving.
Your talk you just gave now here at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology focused in part on water issues and indigenous issues.
Yes.
I want to ask specifically about water as it relates to the Dakotas, where you're working, where you're at. We've seen a cycle of droughts and floods in the last 10 years. What do we know about what's coming next?
Well, the models aren't perfect, and all the climate scientists will say that, but the projections are indicating that we are going to see some variable precipitation patterns. We may not see an increase in precipitation or a decrease in precipitation per se, but what we might see, especially here in the Northern Plains, is how that precipitation comes. If you have a, say, you average 23 inches of precipitation per year, and that might be spread out over 10 events. What we're looking at going into the future might still be 23 inches of precipitation, but spread out over 4, 5, 6 events. So you're looking at more torrential downpours, heavier precipitation events that doesn't have a chance to soak into the ground and become beneficial or useful. Instead, that all gets washed away. And then, of course, the cascading effects that come with that kind of torrential downpour.
More like a monsoon kind of thing.
Well, I wouldn't say monsoon. Exactly. I wouldn't say monsoon. Let's just say that we're going to be dealing with increasing variability in precipitation patterns. It's going to have a dramatic cascading effects through agriculture, through ranching, farming, and especially with the population growth, that increasing demand for water, it's going to be a rather interesting issue that we and the next generation is going to have to deal with.
At this point in time, the state of South Dakota has no comprehensive plan to deal with climate change. We're not seeing folks in agriculture talk to folks in, say, forestry, or talk to disaster management mm-hmm. folks and work on this comprehensive plan. I understand Minnesota and some other surrounding states have a plan like this. Mm-hmm. Our state climatologist has said in the past or agreed that, yes, we should have this kind of plan. Do you think this is necessary, planning on a state level, I guess?
Absolutely. And I think planning at all levels, because I contend that, you know, climate change, climate variability is really a global phenomenon, but the solutions, whether they be mitigation or adaptation measures, have to occur locally. And if that's going to happen, then it takes smaller communities working together, working with larger municipalities, working with the states, tribes working with the states, working with their own communities, working with the federal government from the most local to the national scale, and really coming together with some comprehensive problem-solving strategies that are unique to those specific areas. What happens here in western South Dakota may not be what happens in eastern South Dakota. We've already seen that. Both sides of one state are dealing with very dramatic and very different issues when it comes to water. And so having a more comprehensive a plan, I think, is a must. And bringing to the table not just the stakeholders, those that have a vested interest in water resources, but the most the most information that we can garner to make those informed decisions.
Your research and other research has shown, including in the National Climate Assessment, that indigenous nations can be maybe most adversely affected by climate change.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's just, you're looking at social, economical issues that are already there. And then when you overlay the impacts of a variable climate on top of that, then it only exacerbates those existing conditions. And because limited infrastructure, lack of resources oftentimes in Indian country, it's those marginalized populations that have the most to lose and have the least amount of resources to put towards those solutions.
At the same time, the history, the understanding, the paradigm of indigenous nations can't be ignored here. They can have solutions for us?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's been stated both through this climate assessment process, but also from the previous two IPCC reports that both acknowledge the importance of including those indigenous knowledges in terms of generating new problem-solving initiatives. It has to be more comprehensive, and our best opportunities for getting the best solutions to these problems has to be inclusive.
Your talk just now focused some on the indigenous nations in Alaska, northern Alaska, where tribes are having to move away or being forced to move away from the coastline because of climate change, because of coastal erosion mm-hmm. And warming planet. Are they a canary in a coal mine for other coastal cities, other coastal communities all along the seaboard?
Some argue that. I can say that with some, especially if you take a look at what happens in the Bayou region of Louisiana, they're right at sea level. And as the sea level is projected to rise, you have to look at all other coastal communities that are right at sea level. What happens in those smaller communities also is going to happen in larger municipalities. For example, Miami-Dade, huge metropolitan area. Their sanitation system is pretty much operated by gravity. Well, now, because of sea level rise, we're starting to see backups into those sewage treatment systems, which are really compounding problems for that municipality. we're going to begin to see increasingly more and more of those kinds of issues in bigger municipalities like Miami, like Washington, D.C., like New York City, and so on.
We in America think of individualism as, mm-hmm. as the king. It's all about me and mine. Does that work when it comes to looking at what we need to do to overcome the climate problem?
Well, if you think about it, you know, everybody's affected by climate change. And you think about the diversity of the planet, not to mention, of course, the diversity of the United States and then the diversity of the planet. There's a lot of different perspectives, and everybody has something at stake here. You know, I'm not talking about communism or that sort of thing, but I am talking about diverse knowledges coming together to address situations that affect all of us. There's going to be collateral damage along the way. There always is. Some communities are going to lose out, but we have to stop necessarily thinking about our political life cycle, our quarterly profit life cycle, and start thinking about our life cycle as a species. And it's not that the world's going to come crashing to an end. It's not. What's going to happen is we are beginning to approach a threshold where it becomes increasingly more challenging for life as we know it to continue to exist, given the rate and extent of changes that are occurring.
We've made major changes in the past. World War II, we stopped building cars in Detroit. We started building tanks and airplanes. The whole country came together in a unified way to fight this battle. Is that what we need?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But as long as we get distracted by the fringe noise and don't focus on really getting into problem-solving mode, then as a species, as a society, we have the ability to do great things. President Kennedy put a charge out there. In 10 years, we're going to put a man on the moon. And we hadn't even thought about the mathematics of that, let alone what does that really mean? And we did it in a decade. And that was, you know, in the 60s. Here we are in the 21st century. We have that kind of intellectual firepower. We have that kind of capability. And it's mind-numbing to me that we're so reliant on a 19th century technology, even in the 21st century, and those that hang on to the bitter end to guard profit margins, to defend that very outdated and archaic technology. We can do better. We should be doing better. We have done better. We just have to have the political will to do better.
Can I ask another big picture question? How do you keep from getting discouraged when you look at this kind of pile of research that's happening all the time on what we're seeing and climate change? I guess, do you get a chance to smile? Do you sleep okay at night? You know what I mean?
Well, I can be honest with you. It's been disheartening, especially when you look at the glacial pace in which change occurs and the sense of urgency that I feel both as a professional but also as a father and as a husband, and a commitment that I make to my own children about trying to leave a world that's better than what I found it. And I begin to question whether or not I can do that now. Do I sleep at night sometimes? But thing is as long as I'm still drawing breath, there's hope. That's how I look at it. And I would hope that others take that same perspective, that as long as we're, you know, the Creator has given us a new sunrise and breath in our lungs, then we've got an opportunity to affect change.
Dr. Bull Bennett with Kiksapa Consulting, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was SDPB's Charles Michael Ray speaking with Bull Bennett, one of the lead authors of the Third National Climate Assessment. Next week, the series on energy and the environment continues when we visit with Vance Crocker, Vice President of Operations at Black Hills Power Company.